This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival. The festival, which is based in Bay City, Michigan, will take place in September between the 22nd and 25th of 2016. If you're a filmmaker and you're listening to the podcast and you're thinking of different festivals to potentially submit your film to, consider Hell's Half Mile. I'm very proud to have them as a sponsor. I've been a juror, and I can guarantee you that, indeed, it is a great place to show your film with a very, very appreciative and engaged crowd. And you'll be treated like royalty when you get there, and it's a beautiful town in the heart of the Midwest. So consider submitting your film to Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival. By the way, while you're there, you'll get a great taste of local music, as well as seeing some great films and seeing some great panels and meeting a lot of new friends. You can go to hhmfest.com and find out more. The regular deadline is through March 15th. The late deadline will be later in the spring on April 15th, 2016. Again, the festival takes place September 22nd through the 25th. I welcome Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival as a sponsor. Thank you very much for that. And now on with the show.
This is Michael Imperioli, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff. The name of the podcast is Film Wax Radio. This is episode number 331, and today's guest is Manny Kirschheimer. And I'll come back to Manny in just a little bit. I wanted to share a few things with you. By the way, you might be in Sundance. A lot of people that listen to this show are people in the film industry. A lot of people are filmmakers, and I'm happy for that. On this podcast and the next one or two, I'm going to make a plea of sorts, reaching out to you as filmmakers. I am going to be doing, well, I'm going to be hosting a live event at South by Southwest this spring. It's actually even before the spring. It's at the tail end of winter, because it's going to take place on Sunday, March the 13th. The festival begins on the 11th, both the film and the interactive. The name of the panel is called Indie Film, The Death of the Theatrical. And so far I have on Tim League, who is, of course, the CEO and founder of Alamo Drafthouse, the Drafthouse Films, and Fantastic Fest, based in Austin. And also on the panel is Scott Glosserman, who is the CEO and founder of Gather Films. And I'm looking now for one or two filmmakers or some other industry type who has experimented in how they did their theatrical, and that will be in Austin during this period of time. So if you are, or if you know somebody who will be in Austin and has played around with the exhibition of their film or their theatrical, I would like to be in touch with you. And you can email me right through the website, actually. If you go to the homepage, which is filmwaxradio.com, there's a link to get in touch, and it'll send an email right to me, and I promise to get back to you. Again, you need to have some experience in the world of distribution and exhibition, but if you are a filmmaker who fits that definition, please be in touch, because maybe you can participate in this panel. Again, it's taking place on Sunday, March the 13th, in the Austin Convention Center at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So even if you can't, please put that down in your calendar and come out. It's going to be podcasted as well. And so I look forward to people coming to this event. We're going to talk about re-examining and maybe reinventing what a theatrical looks like. So that's what's going on. I guess, you know, Sundance is the beginning of the next festival season. There's a new wave of great independent films that are breaking out, and I wish I could be there. I say this every year that I do this podcast. I think this is my fifth Sundance doing this podcast. Is that possible? It might be. Fourth or fifth, anyway. But here I am, nevertheless, at home with you. All right, today my guest is Manny Kirschheimer, or I guess he's Manfred Kirschheimer, but we call him Manny. I met Manny last summer. Yeah, it was the summer 2015. And it was around the time of the screening of a restoration of this film. It's called The Stations of the Elevated. And it's all about, it was shot the tail end of the 70s. I think it was the tail end of the 70s. And it was all shot with these elevated trains, all, of course, you know, completely covered by graffiti. And you hear it's just a visual little journey of watching these trains. It's been a while since I've seen it, but it is now available by way of Oscilloscope, which is the distributor. And they've released a lovely package with that film and a number of other works by Manny Kirchheimer. Manny is an interesting guy, and, you know, he's one of these veterans of the documentary world, and I felt compelled to talk with him. I met him there, and then I met him again recently around the holidays at a party, and I ran up to him, and I said, "Oh, you got to do my podcast," and he was right up for it. So we got together and went up to his apartment, and he and his lovely wife were there, and they treated me very kindly. And we did this segment there in their home in Manhattan's Upper West Side. Wikipedia says that Manfred Kirchheimer is a documentary filmmaker and professor of film, which is true, at the School of Visual Arts. And just by way of coincidence, I am going to be curating a screening series. I'll tell you what, I'm going to request that I get a handful of seats at each one of these screens, because they're in a very small screening room at SVA at their, you know, East Campus on East 23rd Street in Manhattan. I put together three screenings initially, starting next month with an upcoming guest of mine. And I'll announce it shortly, because I'll announce my guest soon. And it's a big name. And he's an actor, but he's also a director. And so, but what I'm going to try to do is, first I have to get their permission to do this. But this just kind of came to me in a moment of inspiration. But what I was thinking is, I'll put aside some seats and maybe we can kind of raffle them. Because I think this will be very, very interesting. We're going to show a film and then the filmmakers will be there to do the Q&A. I know it doesn't sound extremely, you know, like I'm reinventing the wheel here. But basically, the idea is that it's more, a little bit more inside baseball in the way that, you know, this is meant for the film department at SVA. But I was really blown away. They asked me to come in and put together these screenings. And so I'm hoping it will be an ongoing thing, because I just love it. I used to do it. In fact, Film Wax was a film series before it was a podcast, before it was even internet radio. It was the Film Wax film series. And I would do these screenings in Brooklyn and invite the filmmakers. And I just sort of cherry-picked films. And so kind of doing that again, only I guess the idea is that we're going to have different themes. So, like, I know one is we're going to get a filmmaker and the editor who they've collaborated a couple of times on a couple of films. And, you know, it's how do they work together? And what are the advantages and disadvantages of how this team actually works together? And I'm very curious about that. And so maybe another one is a social justice doc, but how much do you want to venture into the world of advocacy, and how much do you want to stay away from a kind of didactic approach? This is the kinds of conversations I want to have. Manny Kirchheimer is a documentary filmmaker and a professor of film at the School of Visual Arts in New York. He previously taught at NYIT. I think that's the Institute of Technology here in New York. He was born in Saarbrücken, Germany, and his family moved. They were refugees to New York in 1936 to escape Nazi Germany. After receiving a BA from the City College of New York in 1952, he worked primarily as a film editor, and he also began making his own films. Stations of the Elevated, We Were So Beloved, Tall, The American Skyscraper, and Louis Sullivan, and Art is the Permanent Revolution, and more. Most of these films are available through various distributors. As I say, Oscilloscope has released stuff. First Run Features has released stuff. And I'm sure there's others as well. I'll try to get as much of that information gathered together. But Manny's such a sweet guy, and I had a great time talking to him. And he has very specific ideas about film and digital and these things. And he's been around a long time. And don't you just love those Altacockers? I do. I love having them on the show. And so any opportunity where I can talk to somebody who's been around a long time and who's lived a life that's, to me, the best interviews possible. Yeah, let's just get into it. Right now is here's my conversation with Manny Kirchheimer.
Thank you. will be. We can talk about whatever you want to and not talk about whatever you want to. Not want to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that
there's any taboo.
Any restrictions as far as I'm concerned. No. Did you see the album that Oscilloscope put out?
Did I see what?
See the album.
No.
Let me show it to you.
Yeah, please. Go ahead. It's okay. No problem. We haven't really started.
I want to put music on. Is that going to bother you?
Yes. It depends where. No, in the kitchen, you mean?
No. Try it.
It's okay. Soft music in the background. Are you going to play Gloria?
Yeah.
Are you going to play some of that punk music that the kids listen to?
Punk music?
Yeah.
No,
hard rock and roll, hard stuff, the hard electric guitars. The hard stuff. No, that shouldn't be a problem. I don't think that'll be a problem being in the background. You know, I get all their stuff, so I'm hoping I can Oscilloscope.
Oh, really?
I'm on their mailing list for all their. I haven't gotten that yet. Is it out?
Yeah.
I thought. What? I don't know why I didn't get a copy of it. Maybe they'll send me one.
Open it. I want you to open it up because that's the good part.
Oh, I see. Yeah, they do a nice job.
Don't they do a nice job?
They do. I have a lot of their stuff because I'm on their mailing list, but I'm supposed to get copies of everything. But it's funny I didn't get this yet.
Well, now you can complain.
Well, once they put you on there, then they better.
Right? I mean, isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, it is. It's really nice. I thought that, who distributed the, it was Jake Perlin that distributed, sit down, we can actually even just talk about it. Who distributed the, the BAM, did you have the,
yes, he's my agent.
Oh, I see.
So he contacted them. He also.
He's your sales agent.
We're talking about Jake Perlin.
Jake Perlin, who, you know, is a friend of mine and was a camper of mine. I was a counselor of his in summer camp.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So you're.
That's fine. No problem.
So you're older than he? By a few years?
I will take the fifth, Your Honor. yes.
No, he arranges for these things. And he negotiated with Oscilloscope.
Gotcha.
As well.
I see that. It makes sense. And you were there at the holiday party, the two of you.
Yes.
So it makes sense.
That's right. And am I close enough?
Yeah, you are.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sounds good.
So, yes. And so he arranged for the whole BAM thing, and he arranged for the later BAM shows,
okay.
Which included my next to latest film. Which hasn't been distributed yet, Canners, which is about the people who pick up bottles and cans in town for a nickel. And so he had them play that also, BAM.
Mm-hmm.
And now BAM is thinking of doing other stuff and also repeating these programs, the Stations of the Elevator together with Claw, which is on this recent, both pieces are on this recent Oscilloscope.
Right.
DVD.
Very good. Well, you know, I've covered a lot of their films, so I'm sure I can get myself a copy of Stations of the Elevated, which means that if you're listening and you want to see Stations of the Elevated, after you listen to this conversation with filmmaker Manny Kirchheimer, you can actually purchase a copy through whatever online
Amazon.
Store. Amazon's an easy place to order.
Amazon, and there's a second disc in here that has four other of my early
films. Well, that's great. So you packed them together. That's fantastic. I wish I had gotten this beforehand. I should have taken the steps and gotten a copy beforehand. But it's okay. We can have a nice conversation.
And then after, just to give you a survey.
Yeah.
After Stations of the Elevated, I made. Which probably, well, I don't know if it has a bigger constituency than Stations, but I made We Were So Beloved about German Jewish refugees from Hitler who settled here.
Mm-hmm.
And then four other features, all of which are on DVD, all of which are being
distributed. They're all available.
Except the latest one, Canners.
I got you. Wait, so those other films you said were made subsequent to Stations of the Elevated.
Yes.
And which was restored, correct, and reissued, I guess you could say. Did it ever? It never had when you finished it originally. What year did you shoot
Stations?
Yeah.
1977. And I finished it in 80.
In 80.
Right. And then I went on to make these feature films.
Gotcha.
Which are sort of a different breed from the first five which are represented on the oscilloscope.
Okay. But Stations of the Elevated, okay, did it ever have a theatrical? Then?
No,
okay,
it didn't.
Did it play?
It played at the New York Film Festival.
It did. It was in the New York Film Festival in fall of 80.
1981.
Fall of 81.
Yes.
And then it never quite got the distribution. Is that
it
the
didn't.
Problem?
And it
what a surprise for a kind of an experimental documentary like that.
Well,
there was an underground scene, but maybe.
I mean, after all, the New York Film Festival did take it, and the reviewer of the time, who shall remain nameless, mm-hmm. of the Times, there were 31 films that fall, and she reviewed 30.
Are you serious?
Yes.
She
did not review my film, so it died on the vine. However, graffiti people, word of mouth, bought it and traded it once it came out on VHS. And
who did that, the VHS?
Two people. The Museum of Modern Art and Bruce Ricker, who died 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. He distributed jazz films, and because the track is a jazz track,
right.
he featured Mingus. Mingus was the big name. My name was very small type.
Did Mingus give you, who of course would have been alive in the late 70s, did he?
No. He was, by the time I finished the film, by the time I was doing sound, uh-huh. Which was all put in afterwards, you know, back then, he was dead.
He was dead.
Was working off records.
Okay. And but he died in the 70s, correct? Do you know?
I think he died in 78, 79.
Wow,
too late.
But so how did you get the rights, or did you?
Well, that's a long story. I didn't get the rights.
Mm-hmm.
What we did do is we gave his widow, Susan Mingus, we gave her $1 for every VHS we sold.
Oh.
That was the deal. It was a very simple one, right? Then... For this resurgence, Jake, the story goes like this. Jake calls me 3 years ago. I didn't know him.
Again, Jake Perlin. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And says, what's the status of Stations of the Elevated? I say, you want it? You can have it, but it doesn't have the music rights. And he says, oh, that shouldn't be a problem. And so a year and a half later, he acquired the rights to Mingus and to Aretha, who is on the track as well. So now everything is kosher with that.
Wow. So he acquired the rights specifically for a soundtrack distribution soundtrack of the film, but not in any broader sense. Because
yes. The I had all the other rights, right? No, that is, I didn't have to pay the graffiti writers.
No, what I meant, I'm sorry, getting back just to the Mingus and Aretha Franklin?
Yes.
Tracks?
Both
that,
of them.
Those belong to either, you know, like in Aretha case, I guess it could have been Columbia Records or Atlantic.
In the case of Mingus, I believe it was Atlantic, Prestige, and Columbia.
So they worked out some arrangement, in other words, for this, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's great that they...
Right.
Maybe things are changing a little bit where they're actually human beings considering the context of what they're giving the rights to. Like if it's an IBM commercial, maybe there's a different approach to it than if it's a lovely art film that, you know, however many thousands of people are going to see it, you know, and that the creators aren't standing to make a fortune off of this, you know, that they should be looked at contextually, right?
Well, I guess you have to talk to
Jake,
because I had nothing to do with
it. Well, we have Jake in the room. It just so happens. not quite.
Very funny. But you know who came to our rescue? Jake's outfit is a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And he works on fundraising and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But who came to our rescue was Agnes B., the clothier.
Sure. Oh, right.
And she paid for the music rights.
Oh. How did...
Should I mention a sum?
I don't think there's anything. Okay. I don't think it matters. I mean, why don't you give like a rough... let's see.
It's less than 100,000 and more than 20.
Okay. Okay. So wait, so it's less than 100,000 but more than 20,000.
Yes.
Okay. I guess Jake would also maybe have to say how he made that happen too, but that must be an interesting.
Well, it took much too long. He hired someone. He's not going to hire that person again. Because the guy kept dilly-dallying. And he needed a great deal of prodding. And he was sort of the in-between, and he found a way to get the rights from Mrs. Mingus, from the record companies, and from the, BMI, I think.
Okay, the publisher maybe?
Yeah. So he was able to do that package. And the big surprise to me was Aretha. I had almost given up on her, but he got her apparently as easily as he got Mingus.
That's an incredible.
Money talks, yeah.
So I take it that Susan Mingus is also around?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
She manages the two bands, the two Mingus
bands. Oh, okay, very good. Was she a musician?
No, she was, I think, and I don't want to libel anybody, but I think she was originally a groupie.
Oh.
A very beautiful woman, and they married.
I see. Okay. Well, I just wondered if, like, to manage the bands, maybe, I guess that's more of a kind of a business mind than it is administrative, than it is musical, you know. That makes sense. Well, it's terrific now that people have a chance. I saw it on a great screen. I saw it in BAM, in their large room.
Yeah, in the Harvey.
So, yes. I didn't see it at the Harvey. I saw it actually in the BAM during Cinema Fest. Yeah, but because I said at a press screening, which they had in the upstairs at the BAM in Theater 3,
right.
There, which is a great room because, you know, they just said it's a nice big,
right.
Really big screen.
Well, the Harvey, of course, has a gigantic screen.
Right. I have seen film in there as well, but that's where they did the public screening, right? Is that what you're saying?
They did. Or
did they do the theatrical?
That was the first one. That was the premiere.
Okay.
And they did it together with the actual band, with the live band.
Oh, my gosh. What a great idea.
Yeah. Who played the music from
the
film.
Yeah, that's
our
great.
Original idea was, Jake's original idea actually, was to eliminate the soundtrack from the track and have them play to the film.
Yeah.
But that didn't work out.
Aretha, was too arduous. I know she charges up a few dimes and nickels, and Aretha Franklin would probably be a little bit out of the budget.
Well, no, we would have had to mix it.
Yeah.
We weren't going to get Aretha.
Right.
Besides, I think she was sick at the time. She was just making a comeback.
I think you're right, timing-wise. So what you're saying is then, since the 81, you made what number... Now, you referred to them as features, like a handful of features, but that they're still nonfiction, though, correct?
That's right.
Did you ever make a narrative?
And it's on the DVD.
And is it a short?
It's 45 minutes.
Okay. I guess that's what you call a mid-length.
Yes. And that's called Short Circuit.
Okay.
And Jake is eager to put that on tour.
Okay.
With another short film of mine. So that's in the works. You know, and also... No, I shouldn't say this. Retrospectives are in the works, too.
Oh, well, you said it.
Well, no, but I was going to mention the places.
Oh, okay.
But I better not. It's two organizations, and I'd rather not mention
it. Oh, no problem. Not at all.
Right. Here's a plug. New movie theater is opening in town.
I know.
The Metrograph. And it's
a nice old-fashioned name.
Yes, it is. Jake Perlin is going to curate it.
I know.
And it's on Ludlow, on Ludlow, just off Canal.
Right.
Over the across the street from the site of the gigantic Lowy's Canal, which has been closed for many years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's very promising because Jake's taste is wonderful and he's going to play great stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah, I encourage people to come out, and once that place opens,
yeah, February 19th.
Oh, it's February 19th. Okay, very good. Well, there will be a theater for films of the avant-garde.
Yes.
Would you feel would you put some of your a good amount of your work in that category?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, I really don't. My films, although, you know, they're a little poetic or a little lyrical, you might say, those early films. I was working from the work of the masters in the 30s and the 20s. I didn't feel
you seem like Robert Flaherty? Who are you talking about?
No. Well, I'm talking about Leo Hurwitz.
Because I don't know a lot of those names. I'm talking about Go ahead. Yeah,
Willard Van Dyke. I'm talking about Joris Evens. You know those names.
I really don't. And
you
don't. There's holes in my knowledge. I hope to. Not, I'm not losing your respect, but I have. I'm pretty transparent about my ignorance.
Well, we studied all those films in school. I went to City College, which had the first documentary film institute in America, led by Hans Richter, the Dadaist painter who made what was called experimental films at the time. Dreams That Money Can Buy, 8x8, stuff like that. And he was one of the pioneers in the 20s, along with René Clair and some others who made these short experimental films. Anyway, it wasn't the experimental, Dolly, that got to me so much as the good documentaries that I studied there. And these good documentaries were, the Grierson School in England, the Germans, the Russians. And so I was really carrying on what they had done. I didn't feel in my wildest film, which isn't very wild, Stations of the Elevated, that was avant-garde, no.
Mm-hmm.
What it was, and it wouldn't have been considered such,
right,
except that it came out at the same time. That was the heyday of cinema verite.
Right.
And documentaries had shifted to that. My kind of documentary back then made shot films without sound, edited them montage style, and added the sound later. Right, and cinema verite, which, by the way, Leo Hurwitz also pioneered back in 1952 with a film called The Young Fighter. I can tell you that whole history. Cinema verite, in which the camera always records dialogue as it shoots. By 1977, when I was shooting Stations, was what you saw everywhere.
Right.
That was the
Pennebakers and the Measles,
right?
And the
and so anybody making it in the old style was different. And for example, during that time, very few poetic type films came out.
Right.
They were all very quotidian.
Mm-hmm.
Was the language that counted most, actually. And there was a sort of deterioration in picture quality for the longest
time.
Sure.
Oh, because now handheld was coming.
And it was also handheld, and it wasn't. It often wasn't metered, and it zoomed back and forth to get focus.
Right.
Right on. Well, in the middle of a shot.
Sure. Well, because somebody may be saying something very important, and that was the key issue, not the way the film looked as much.
Right.
It took a back seat, in other words.
Now, today, that was a transitional period, but that transition went on for 20, 25 years, and today those films are made much better, although there is a good deal of hand-holding. We talk about the reality shows and so on, which don't care that much for picture quality.
Mm-hmm.
But documentaries themselves are better than they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But they mostly use that method. And I'm a teacher, and I have students make films, and I ask them to turn off the sound when they're making it, so that they can make a story dependent on picture.
Where do you teach?
School of Visual Arts in New York.
Do you work out of the main campus area on East 23rd Street?
We'll be
running into each other because I've been asked to do a number of things with the SVA in their film department.
Oh.
They want to do a screening series. They want to focus on conversations. They want to make it like more about the Q&A than they do the actual film. So, in other words, let's say a typical film series, it's about the film, and then you get a QA after. But this is really almost as much about the conversation and access to the filmmakers.
I see.
So that's the kind of the focus of this series.
In any case,
go ahead.
It's a very good question about my. I have nothing against avant-garde, but I just don't consider my films. I don't think that I've done...
I can see that, yeah.
I don't think I've done something new. Avant-garde means you're doing something new.
Oh, true. I'm also looking at it, like, from my perspective, and I'm almost like kind of the avatar for the moviegoer, like kind of the devil's advocate here, that I because what we do now is we have a difficulty knowing how to talk about films that don't fall into the more conventional documentary format. And so these kinds of other films, which I end up having to talk about a lot because they intrigue me, or the people that make them intrigue me, we call them, we have all sorts of names for it, and they seem to fall into this experimental bucket because we don't really have a better word for it that most people can hold on to and, you know, grab onto.
Yes, but even experimental means that it's new, right? I don't feel that that's my strength. I don't think I do things that are new. I think I utilize things that are old and do my best with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been watching the Sherlock series.
Mm-hmm.
And have you seen any of those?
No, not yet.
Because
I
think that's new. Mm-hmm. I think that's experimental. New way of telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
Aspects of it, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I understand exactly what you mean. And how have you historically referred to your type of filmmaking?
Well,
if we have
recent filmmaking, after I made this large film about the German Jewish refugees called We Were So Beloved, which was two and a half hours long.
Mm-hmm.
That was a talk film, interview film. And although I don't like, you know, I don't like to call it talking heads. I don't like that term.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sort of a denigrating term. It's, you know, this is, anyway, then my next film, Tall, which is about the growth of the American skyscraper, has a voiceover. I don't do any interviews in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I use montage to present the growth of the skyscraper.
I see.
Then the next film was Spraymasters, which is a follow-up to Stations of the Elevated, in which I actually do talk to four of the people, three guys.
The graffiti or taggers?
The graffiti writers.
Did you talk to Lee Quinones?
I did.
Okay.
He's in it, and Lady Pink is in it, Futura 2000, and Zephyr. And Lee has become a really good friend.
I think that's another connection to Charlie Ahern, who we also were talking with.
That's how come I got to know him, you know.
Yeah, sure. Who would be better for connecting you?
But I only met him about 5 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in France.
Uh-huh.
When both our films played at a graffiti show.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a film called Art is the Permanent Revolution, which is a talk and how-to film, right? Because the artists are working and we're watching them work, but they're also talking as they work. So, you know, so I'm now in, I mean, those are mainstream films. And then I made Canners, and that's also talking, right? So when you say, how would you categorize your film?
Documentaries.
Yeah, I think, they're documentaries, but I think the first four out of the five that are on here, because one is fiction, the other four, which were all made without dialogue, are what? They're lyrical.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You have more descriptives than you would than kind of
categories. You know, it works for me. Nonfiction, okay. Lyrical.
These are lyrical films.
Yeah.
Well, you know Stations. You know that one
yes.
of mine.
Yes.
That's a lyrical film.
True.
Yes.
Yeah.
Although that doesn't even have voiceover.
No. Right. It's exactly what you described earlier when you said it was shot, then cut, montage.
Yes.
And then sound was put in over at the afterwards in post yes. with the Mingus music and...
And the sound effects.
And the, oh, right. And the train. And the trains, so which just plays a huge effects. Effect. Yeah. So describe... Yeah, for those, again, who have not seen this film, it is the elevated subways of New York.
Covered with graffiti.
Yeah.
Back in 1977.
Which a train without graffiti would if they existed, would have been an exception, which would have been
not,
a, would have been a freak.
Exist. Yeah. It did not exist at the time.
Yeah. They were very ambitious graffiti artists that were... It was their heyday because some of them would try to do like a full train in one night. And right? I mean,
yeah,
there were some cases where they're masterpieces.
Yeah.
And
Masterpieces didn't mean it was good. It just meant it was a full car.
a full train. And then they would do like
a full car.
Just one car?
Yeah.
But I know there were cases where they tried to do
yes,
like
they
more
did 10 cars. They did a whole train.
Yeah.
That, far as I know, that only happened once.
Okay, yeah, I think maybe I heard
that. The Fabulous Five and Lee supervised that.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
He had a number of pieces on
Fabulous Five.
Yes.
Is that Fab Five Freddy? Or is that something?
Well, he was part of it, I think.
He was. That's where he got his name?
I don't know.
I was kidding. I'm not
a graffiti historian.
We'll bring in some.
I don't know.
Well, maybe I can
much.
Get Lee on if he. I don't know if he does interviews, but we'll see. I'll talk to Charlie about him and about that.
Right.
But who also? He also, of course, this all also played into his film, Charlie's film, Wild Style.
Charlie's is Wild Style.
Wild Style. Yeah. And so you grew up in New York,
yes.
I take it, right? Did
That's
you grow up
right.
in the Bronx or did you grow
no,
up in...
No, Washington Heights.
Oh, here, okay. Very good. It's Upper Manhattan. Well,
totally Manhattan.
The Bronx is right across the river there, that's all.
That's right. The Bronx is across the river. That's where Yankee Stadium is. And that's the only
yes.
time we ever visited the Bronx to go to Yankee Stadium.
Gotcha. Yeah, of course.
When we were kids.
And I grew up near Mets Stadium, Shea Stadium.
Oh. Well, I'm
that's
a Mets
where I was.
Fan.
Okay. To this day or just...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Aren't you?
Yeah, I am. Yes, of course. I mean, I'm always glad if a New York team is winning, whatever, but I don't put quite... My heart's not in it as much as, you know, there's a spirit to it, but my heart's really in it if the Mets... Like this past year, the Mets were doing quite well.
Yes.
You know, so that was fun to see. And so you grew up in Manhattan, in Washington Heights.
Correct.
And then did you know at what point... were you planning on being... An artist, or did you have other ideas?
I thought I'd be a chemist. And I went to City College
uh-huh.
of New York, and a couple of whiffs of that chem lab told me, no, I don't really want to do this. But at the same time, in 1949, the students went out on strike against a racist professor and an anti-Semitic professor.
At the City College?
At City
Which
College.
Is mind-boggling that could have happened because of
all those
old Jews that came out of there.
That's or right.
They started
that's
off
right.
as young Jews, of course.
And then the racist, you know, name was Knickerbocker. It's no secret. He had it out for blacks. So anyway, school went out.
Mm-hmm.
And one kid with a small camera, Filmo, if that means anything to you, Bell and Howell Filmo, was shooting the scene, you know, and I went over and I said, well, who's this for? What are you doing this for? Film was expensive, you know. You didn't see 16-millimeter cameras on the street. Mm-hmm. And he said, for the film department, I'm a film student. So I followed that up. I thought that intrigued me. And I visited...
He was shooting the protest. There was a protest.
Yeah, he was shooting the demonstration.
There was a demonstration about regarding Knickerbocker,
and
so he
and
was sort
Davis.
Of
Knickerbocker and Davis.
Oh,
those
two.
Were the two.
It predated the cell phone camera phone
That's
by
right.
by a number of decades.
That's right. Actually, he was shooting the back of a horse shitting, a police horse,
mm-hmm.
and So I approached him, and so then I made an appointment with Hans Richter, known as Professor Richter, at the school, to see what that was all about. My father had said, ask him if there are any opportunities in film before you decide on this. So I went up there. I went down there. He had a basement office in what was called Army Hall at the time, in an old Charles Adams-type building. And I said, Professor Richter, are there any opportunities in film? And he says, yeah, opportunities, there are plenty, but no jobs. So that was cool. He was wrong. He was wrong. There were plenty of jobs, but very few opportunities, actually. And but we hit it off. We became, we liked each other. You know, I became his pet, sort of. Mm-hmm. And I worked for him right after I got out of school.
So they're sort of protégés, what do you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, we were both Germans. We were both refugees, Hans and I. And I worked for him for a while. He was making his second big American film, 8x8, mm-hmm. and his documentary about chess called The Passionate Pastime. He originally called it Chess-Cetera, which I thought was a much better title.
It's certainly funny.
You know, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, so is Dreams That Money Can Buy, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. he had a terrific sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how come I got into film. Then I got a job after I graduated in the industry.
I see. Where were you born? You were born in Germany?
I was born in Germany.
You were?
I was born in Saarbrücken, Germany. I was there for my first 5 years. But
And your parents were refugees?
They were refugees from
Hitler.
They left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they got out, obviously, in the nick of time.
They got out in the nick of time in 1936.
Oh, thank God.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank God. You're right about that.
And did they have they must have had a hard time of it.
Mm,
I mean,
yes
by
and no.
comparison.
Well, sure, anybody who has to emigrate. I mean, look at what the migrants today, you know.
Sure.
They had a worse time. The Tsar region where Saarbrücken is, which, by the way, in 2 weeks I'll be there for a film festival. They have the Max Ophuls Prize film festival every year. And they always invite me, and I take a program of student films from SVA.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Anyway, Saarbrücken is the capital of the Tsar region. And the Tsar region was administered by France under the League of Nations mandate after World War One. And in 1935, the League of Nations ran a plebiscite. What do you people want to do? You want to stay with France? You want to go to Germany? Or you want to just leave it the way it is? And they voted overwhelmingly to go over to Germany. And that's when my father made preparations to leave. He immediately lost his job mm-hmm. once that voting came out. But he was able to, he was a designer for a department store. Did all the interior designs and the exterior designs. They would run, you know, six-story advertising on the outside of the building.
Oh, wow.
And he would design that. And so they fired him, but they kept him on because nobody could do the job as well as he. But he had to go through the back entrance and walk up the stairs to his office.
Mm.
So he accepted that humiliation for a year while he was planning to leave.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they moved here in 36, you said?
That's correct.
They
moved here in 36.
Okay. And to Manhattan?
To Manhattan, to Marble Hill, 225th Street, where two of my dad's brothers already lived. And they got an apartment for us and everything.
Well, they left earlier.
They had left earlier, not for the same reasons. They
I
had
see.
Left for economic reasons, like in 1929, before Hitler.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So that probably was a big help, of course.
Of course.
Yeah, my goodness. And so you
How old were you? You said
I was five.
5 years old. So you don't have any memories before. Although there's such a marked contrast, maybe you have some vague or memories rather.
It's sort of individual incidents. Yeah, a little bit.
Sure.
Of Germany, you mean?
Yeah.
And of the ship coming over. Yeah.
Even the ship.
Well, I saw my first film on the ship ever.
Is that true?
Marlene Dietrich, film called Desire.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah.
You actually remember that?
Like, well,
or
I
just
remember
you remember that
because
event?
I thought it, first of all, I didn't want to go. I was scared.
Sure.
I was very scared because there was once, never mind. I was very scared to go to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I did go there, I liked it so much that I laughed my head off and I had to be ejected because I was spoiling the mood for the other audience.
What do you think? It was just the joy?
I don't know. I thought it was all so funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a funny film, Desire.
Wow, that's an incredible story. So you were 5 years old. So you were born in 31.
Yes.
I guess.
Yes, I'm 84 now.
Okay. Geez, you just, it sounds like you're not slowing down very much because you're traveling quite a bit and
I'm working
teaching,
on three films at the moment, yeah. I'm just finished the editing of Joao Lee's film. Joao Lee is my friend and colleague from school, and she's the sister of Spike.
Oh, sure. Yes, I know who she is. Yeah.
She's, you know, just...
I've seen her running around, like on her bike. And
yeah, she's a wonderful person.
Is she?
And she turns out to be quite a talented director. And so I volunteered to cut this short. It's just 8 minutes. But she's... doing a number of what she calls subway vignettes. And this is one of them, and it was fun editing it.
What's a subway vignette in this case? Like, is it a fiction film?
Yes, or? Yes.
Okay.
These stories are fiction.
Mm-hmm.
This one is about two young women, one carrying trays of food and the other one carrying an eight-month-old baby,
mm-hmm.
who don't have the money to go into the subway. They're standing outside the turnstile, asking people for a swipe,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm. And it turns out that then she comes running down the stairs. My friend Joao, she plays the lead role, Coco, and she doesn't have any money either.
Mm-hmm.
And when she tries to upgrade her card, put some money on it, there's nothing in her debit
mm-hmm.
at all.
Mm-hmm.
I won't spoil the story, but anyway, she goes in and the kids are left outside the turnstile, but eventually something happens.
Gotcha. How are we going to see these things to be?
You know, she's thinking of webcast.
That makes sense, right?
I don't know.
Let me ask you a question now that we're on the subject. You're editing. I have to imagine that she's shooting digitally, so you're just now editing on your computer?
For sure.
Yeah.
In the next room, I'll show it to you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Digital is wonderful, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a great, great, great fan of digital.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad film is gone. And this has given extra years to my life. And I have arguments all the time with people about film versus digital, including Jake.
Yeah.
Jake is a very big film man.
I imagine.
He's my good friend, but we fight about it all the time.
It's the irony there because he's the young guy who
grew
up in the age of digital, and yet you grew up in the age of
film.
of celluloid, and yet you know
our roles are reversed.
But you understand the right because as you get older, you realize this has allowed you to be a lot more creative in the moment and in a faster in terms of at least production.
Well, but also people put digital down as being
inferior.
They say it's too beautiful, too even, too pixelated instead of grained, I don't know. They say all sorts of things, you know, but if you look and you know what, and I think it's because they've seen lousy digital work.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at, let's say, the BBC productions, if you look at Sherlock, if you look at Downton Abbey, you know, I mean, it's the lighting. And you give it fabulous lighting, and the whole thing looks fabulous. And it's the story, the content, that counts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't regret, you know, I mean, some people I've talked to like grain, they like little scratches.
Yeah, I understand.
And stuff like that.
I don't understand
that at all.
Well, it is.
My whole life is against grain. I just wrote a piece that I presented at a conference called Against the Grain.
What a great title. where did you write that? That was just presented in person?
I just presented it downtown.
I see.
In October. Yeah, because, I mean, when we were working in film, we tried all the time to hide the grain by using the slowest film, who needs grain?
What other secrets are there?
Secrets?
Well, trade secrets, which doesn't mean it's a... which, you know, most people then know.
Oh, you mean hiding
grain, in other words, what are some techniques that...
It meant you needed to light more because you were using slower film. Slower film produces
so more light through the aperture,
grain.
Right?
You had to, yeah, that's right. But you had to, yes. And now, you know, digital is so remarkable. It can do anything. Mm-hmm. If you want, you know, I favored reversal film, both in black and white and in color. And if you want that look today, well, you have it in front of you. You have the example. All you have to do is shoot digital and then go to After Effects and work on it until it looks like film. I'm not talking about the little film items that you get in your editing system. I'm talking about really creating the
Ken Burns effect. Trust me, I talked to Ken Burns
about that. Forget about the Ken Burns effect. Ken Burns effect pisses me off on account of we've been doing that forever. You know, and then he popularized it in, I think, the Civil War, suddenly it became his. I mean, that kind of thing with the slow zoom and everything. We've been doing that ever since they invented zoom lenses.
A zoom in a pan is what we're referring to.
Yeah, a zoom in a pan.
But it's always the credit's always given to the one who popularizes it, and he just happened to be the right place at the right time. I brought it up and with him, and he kind of went into a tirade of sorts. He was rude, but he did because then Apple who
yeah included
makes
it, right?
it part of their palette of yeah. you know effects. In their editing tools.
Perfectly right. Good for Apple. Mm-hmm. Because he didn't invent the stuff. Mm-hmm. What's her name? It'll come to me. But anyway.
Is she a so-called
experimental filmmaker.
Okay.
Amaya Darin.
Okay.
Nothing experimental about what she does. It was done in the early 20s. You know. It's for people who don't know film who say things like that.
Sure. Well, that's most of us. But, I mean, we give usually credit to, the one that we connect with on some level.
That's self-promotion. You wouldn't have noticed that if it hadn't been promoted.
Fair enough, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a filmmaking technique, for goodness sake.
Right.
You know. Mm-hmm. I mean, most people don't notice edits who don't know about film.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know.
Sure. Right. And the idea is that there's two things. One is you try to hide them as a craftsperson.
Yeah.
On the other hand, also, we as viewers, we see it so often that we...
It's part of the language. It's grammar.
Yeah, right. And we don't...
It's
right.
grammar.
And so
right.
we no longer... We don't notice it anymore.
That's right.
Because we're trained that way.
Well, we grew up with it.
Habits.
It's like
yeah.
the language.
I mean, yes.
When you're talking, you know, there's the famous Molière... in one of his plays,
yeah. uh-huh.
in which he's told that...
In French, by the way.
in French. He's told that... I don't know how it goes exactly, but anyway, he's told that he's talking prose, mm-hmm. which is a big revelation to him, you know. He's been talking prose all his life. And, you know... So, you know, naming something suddenly makes you conscious of it.
Right, I see what you mean. Yes, right, of course. Just to get back to one earlier point we were talking about a couple of minutes ago regarding this love and loyalty to the grain, to the film. Right. Film.
Yes.
To the film, watching celluloid. I'm going to tell you that if you look at I could tell you the exact age of people that have this feeling. There's an age range. It's very specific. And it would be people who probably coming out of college at a particular year for like a period of, you know, the years coming out of college, film school, or where they were first exposed to film. And so it was their formative years as film goers, which was probably still in the early 80s, maybe tail end of 70s through into the 80s, before the age of digital. So they were first exposed to a certain type of film where they fell in love with film. And so they have a nostalgic and emotional attachment to the aesthetic of film. Going back maybe earlier, and somebody who was working with it from the beginning, or from rather going way back, maybe there's less of that same kind of attachment to it. And certainly kids that are coming up today, they weren't exposed to that. They don't have that relationship with film. You know?
So there's a nostalgia element.
I think that's a big part of it. Yeah. It's like this is part of my experience when I fell in love with film, so I'm going to be have a very deep, you know, affection for it. And so I think that those people that are real pro film, and some of them are very famous filmmakers.
Yes.
Quentin Tarantino, as we know, is because even Hateful Eight has first been in CinemaScope, for God's sake. But and then there's
70 millimeter,
right?
Yeah.
So that's like a statement. It's not even an aesthetic decision. He's
right.
Making a statement. And then there's a handful of other guys like Scorsese for a while. But I think he works in digital too. Well, there's the small group of select filmmakers that are very attached to continuing.
Right.
And I think also P.T. Anderson, Paul Thomas Anderson, still works in film.
Well, you can still work in film. That's cool, especially if you have a big budget.
Right.
Then what's the big deal? But for the rest of us, digital is a godsend. You know, digital.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it because it's only cheaper and faster. I'm saying it because it's beautiful. The thing is, it's so good now that, as you know, it can shoot at nighttime. It can shoot in lighting like this perfectly well. Mm. And except lighting like this is not beautiful. But people do it. Mm-hmm. And so the film looks like, it looks lousy. Okay?
He's editing himself now.
And yeah. Mm. And if they light it, as they should, they should never rely on not lighting it. Never. Just like you, in setting up these microphones, Adam, don't rely on the microphone inside your recorder. It's the same thing. The microphone inside your recorder, if you put it here in the middle of the table, will record what we are talking about, but it will be very poor quality. And that's what shooting without lights in dark situations is also. So there's a lot of that going on, and it gives digital a bad name. But digital, of course, can be magnificent. And when it is, then the focus is on the content, where it always should be anyway.
Do you get into these debates with your students? I don't know what kind of teacher you are.
A little bit. Maybe not much. You know, the students are a little shyer. But I think many of them come to film school just to learn film. And I think my bosses don't really want me to teach film now. And I think this will be the last year because the labs have left New York, and we have to send out for developing and printing. So I think I'm going to be teaching film for the last time. But, you know, you're saying, well, you're a digital guy. How come you're teaching film? I'm teaching film so that they can shoot digitally better, so that they understand what an f-stop is, so that they can manually do the things that are automatic, like white balance, for which they need a filter nowadays if they're going to shoot outdoors.
For people listening, white balance is you shoot the first, before you start shooting, you get a white, it gives you a perfect
white.
Right,
you adjust for color.
Okay.
You don't want there to be a blue or a pink tint.
Going into it, yeah.
Right, so, it seems to me that that's best understood if they work a little bit with film.
Mm-hmm.
you know, focus can be automatic on these cameras. Exposure can be automatic on these digital cameras. F-stop is just a number, unless you know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I'm teaching film. I'm not teaching film to show it in the movie theater, because it won't be anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's a goner. Let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
Much as you might love film, it's going to be gone. And as a matter of fact, if digital had come out first, nobody would ever have thought of inventing film.
Well, that's a logic I haven't heard,
so
come
cumbersome.
Across yet. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Well, that's amazing. Okay, so let's remind people again, Stations of the Elevated is now available on this DVD along with a number of other shorter works by Manny Kirchheimer.
Yes, it's distributed by Oscilloscope, and you can get it on Amazon.
Yeah. And is other work available?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Two of my films are available. Two of my films are available at First Run Features.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yes. And
Seymour's operation.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Seymour Wishman's operation. Mm-hmm. And three of them are available at the Cinema Guild.
Oh, very good. They're great, too.
Yes. And these are individual DVD feature-length films.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Great. Well, I hope people search them out, you know, as a result of listening, and we'll introduce some new people to your work.
That would be wonderful.
And I'll keep people abreast of these retrospectives that we can expect.
Yes. Retrospectives and my film Canners, which is not yet distributed.
Right.
My agent is trying for a theatrical release for that film. It had already had a sneak preview at BAM.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that BAM will show it.
That'd be great.
Over a longer period, but also...
How long is that film? What did you say the running time was?
77 minutes.
Oh, so that's a...
It's feature length.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And it follows people who collect and try to get their deposits on...
Yeah. You know, you've seen them on the street.
Sure.
They have mountainous bags full of cans and bottles.
They're balancing these enormous bags of... cans on these usually much smaller carts,
yes,
or whatever. Yeah.
And I'm interviewing 20 of them in the film,
uh-huh.
And their lives are better than you think.
Hmm.
Yes, and furthermore, they're more interesting. They're not down and outers. They work very hard.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Yes, and many of them in the film are very interesting. So that's another, and I'm making some new ones, so
great.
There'll be more, I hope.
Well, you're an inspiration.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well, it's great to see. I'm glad. It's great to see people that are, you know, in their 80s still being extremely productive and hungry, and you know, that's terrific.
You got to be lucky.
Yeah. Well,
you
sure.
You got to be lucky to be healthy and to live this long and to have digital at your side.
Yes.
I've got my films. I have some devoted students who are really good friends who shoot for me. Students, you know, from 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
who shoot. And so I'm able to make a film if there are no rights involved. I'm able to make a film, a feature-length film documentary for $5,000.
It's really, it's just, you couldn't even conceive of such a thing, you know, 20 years ago.
You know, that's right. And I pay my people in dinners, breakfasts, and occasional gifts, usually art books, usually old ones that I've found on eBay that are goodies. Yeah, yeah. Just gave away a beautiful Blake book, beautifully printed, about the Book of Job.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, my main cameraman, Zachary Allspaugh, who lives out on the coast, is studying for the priesthood, if you can believe it.
Really? So Blake would be right up his alley.
Blake will be right up his alley. He's a wonderful man, and he's not totally decided, but he's given 2 years to, you know, it's a 7-year course of study to become a priest.
Yeah, right. It's divinity school.
I'm telling you, very arduous, you know, a lot of philosophy and stuff.
Sure.
And so, and a lot of practical work. That's what he's doing out there. But he comes in when I have a film to shoot. He's very devoted, and we like working with each other.
That's great.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for sitting and taking all this time. I appreciate it, considering it sounds like you're real busy.
Yeah, this is a very pleasant vacation.
Oh, good. Right, and it is coming to an end.
Yes. Right. Thank you very much, Adam, for coming up here.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. I know you got to get back to your marathon film sessions and over in the Park City. So go ahead and do that. Next up, we're going to be celebrating 50 years of the Cartemquin Films. That's the production company in Chicago that helps produce the films of Steve James and so many other filmmakers. And I brought on, I talked to Tim Harsborough, who's been there for quite a while, the publicity side of the business. And it was a great conversation, I have to say. And so we're going to play that next week. And so please do tune in for that. It's another great conversation, and it'll just be the single longer format conversation. And then we'll get back to kind of a couple of different segments the following weeks. I want to thank Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival again for sponsoring these past bunch of episodes in the last couple of months. Even though their current sponsorship is coming to an end, I will go on singing their praises because it is a terrific festival. And I even heard that there's been a little bit of traction that some filmmaker last week heard about Hell's Half Mile through listening to this podcast and reached out to them. So whoever you are, and if you're listening now, thanks for doing that, and thanks for dropping the name Filmwax Radio. If you are in a film festival, if you work at a film festival, consider sponsoring an episode. We can work it out, so it's very affordable, and frankly, it's a great collaboration. It's a great partnership, because a lot of filmmakers do hear about festivals by listening to this podcast, and we also have a lot of programmers on this podcast, you know, so it's just a great resource, I think, and reach out to me. You can reach me, again, by going to filmwaxradio.com. And there is a way to email me through the website right there on the homepage. You can also reach out through Facebook, of course. I have my own page, Adam Chartoff, Schartoff, and there's a Filmwax Radio page as well. There's Twitter. You can reach me at Filmwax Radio. And please do reach out to me. It would be great to hear from you. Until next time, everybody, take care. We'll be in touch soon.